Neighbors and fences. It's all shifted over here.
Yeah, so should move to the left.
I don't want to take too much of Rabbi Berzon's time, but I do want to just offer our Hakara Satov, our gratitude to Rabbi Berzon for joining us here this evening. I first sat in Rabbi Berzon's shir in Mivaseret when I was there visiting my cousin 23 years ago, a long time ago. My sister owes a lot to Rabbi Berzon, of course, as the founding Rosh Hashiva of Mivaseret and the Mivaseret institutions, now working in the Amek Learning Center, which is a community-based learning opportunity in Eretz Yisrael. And I will say that just this is part of our Israel week here at BRS, and for the first time, when we were planning the week, we said to ourselves, how can we have a week celebrating Eretz Yisrael when all we do is talk about the politics of Eretz Yisrael? How could we have an Israel week without infusing it with the Torah to Eretz Yisrael? And when I heard Rabbi Berzon was going to be in Florida around this time, I said, what better person to both represent Torah and the Torah of Eretz Yisrael than Rabbi Berzon? So we're deeply grateful that you're joining us here this evening. Again, I won't take up too much of your time, but please rise and join me in welcoming Rabbi Azariah Berzon.
Thank you so much.
And thanks to everyone for coming tonight. One of the great proponents of Torah Eretz Yisroel was, of course, Rav Kook. I'm talking about the first Rav Kook, the chief rabbi of Palestine before the establishment of the state, Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Kook. And by way of introduction, let me tell you this. His Hebrew is very, very tough, very challenging. For decades and decades, I've been trying to figure it out. But for this year, for the first time in my life, I think I understand what he's saying. I'm not going to promise you, but we'll learn it together. For those who like a text, I photocopied the text. Rav Kook is one of the few contemporary rabbis who actually wrote a commentary on the Agadita. The Agadita is very tough, and very few of the giants, my Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik, for example, occasionally, really very rarely, would address an Agadita. And generally speaking, if we learned the Masechta up at YU, and there was an Agadita which was more philosophical and homiletical, Rav Soloveitchik would skip it. That was generally the way that yeshivot learned the Gemara. They would skip Agadita, because the Agadita is written in a code. And Rav Kook decided to try to decipher that code. So he has a sefer on Masechta Brachot, which is called Ein Raya. That's the Rashi Tevas, the abbreviation of his name. I'm going to try to give a little bit of a background to the first piece that we want to study, which is on page 1. And then we'll try to flip the page to page 2. That's another piece in which he's interpreting another Gemara, Masechet Brachot, and see if we can find some sort of integration between the two pieces. To introduce the first piece, which is an analysis of a Gemara in Masechet Brachot, the Gemara tells us, Gadol Masha Nemar B'Michael. This Agadita is comparing and contrasting two of the most prominent angels that serve God, but down here on this earth. One is Michael and the other is Gabriel. And you and I would never have thought to try to compare two angels, you know, who's greater than the other one, but the Gemara takes that on. Gadol mashenemar b'Michael, mimashenemar b'Gabriel. I guess you'd say that Michal is one up it over Gavriel. De'ilu b'michal k'tiv, with regard to Michal, the pasuk describes this angel as vayaf elai echad min asrafim. And this verse in Tanakh, again, if we had a lot of time tonight, we'd go through the entire chapter in Tanakh, but just what's relevant to us, because I want to get to Rav Kook, is that the Tanakh describes Michal as vayaf. Vayof means he flies. He's on the move. The ilu b'Gavriel, but in contrast, in the case of Gavriel, the pasuk says, "V'ha'ish Gavriel asher ra'isi b'chazon, b'tchila mu'af b'yaf. Now in Hebrew grammar, the mu'af is causative. It is passive. It's not active. So if in contrasting Michael is the active angel in heaven, whereas Gavriel is passive. Now Rav Kook notices a second difference that is intimated by this comparison, and that is, in the case of Michael, it's vayaf. There's only one verb describing his activity because he's active. And in the case of Gavriel, in order for Gavriel to achieve his function, he's got to double it over. He's got to have both mu'af and bi'af. So there's an extra effort that Gavriel has to sort of input of energy in order to achieve his goal. Now again, this Gemara, if you learn it, it is, again, I don't want to use the word gibberish because that sounds negative, but I mean, it's really a sefer hasasim. It's completely closed. You know, we really don't have any clue as to what function, what is the contribution of Michael as opposed to Gavriel, and why Michael is considered greater than Gavriel. And Rav Kook decides that he's going to take this on. In order to take this on, he presents two views, two answers to the following question: how does a person achieve emunah, faith? Now, we just recently celebrated Pesach. Pesach is called Chag Emunah. It is the festival of faith. In fact, in the Zohar, the matzah itself is called Nehemna Dimnehemnusa. It's the bread of belief. And over again on the Leil Pesach, we declare and acknowledge our belief. God took us out of Mitzrayim, and we repeat that over and over again. However, we don't find, this is what Rav Kook points out, that in the context, in the framework of this Chag, of this holiday of Emunah, of faith, that we are actively trying to understand God, to analyze, to use our intellect to define God or to prove His existence. For those of you who may have a little exposure to the history of philosophy, I'm talking about human philosophy, you may know that during the course of centuries, millennium, the philosophers tried to prove the existence of God. And there are three major proofs for the existence of God. We're not going to go through them now. You know, the ontological proof is the most challenging of them all, but there are other proofs of God's existence. That is where the human being uses his intellect to analyze, to adduce proofs and evidence on a logical basis that God really exists. There's another approach, a different mode, if you will, of achieving emunah, of faith. And that is what I would call tmimut. Let me try to explain what the word tmimut was. I wrote myself a list of possible adjectives in English. Tmimut means something that's straight, that's smooth, without complications, without ups and downs, without any doubts. It's natural, it's wholesome, it's something that evolves for the inner sense of the soul. It flows from the heart, and it expresses the concept of yashrut. Yashrut means when something is, in Yiddish we say gleich, it's something smooth. It has no ups and downs, no jagged edges. It's a certain simplicity, but I hesitate to use the word simplicity because that might sound pejorative. And what we're going to see in Rav Kook is that this second approach to belief in God is the superior approach. In other words, we have the mind and the heart. The mind is dedicated to an intellectual comprehension and proof of God's existence. That's one mode or approach to emunah. And Rav Kook suggests a different approach, which he calls yashrut or tmimut. which means that it's simple in the positive sense because it avoids all the somersaults in the air. You know, when you do logical analysis, you know, there's an argument and a counter argument. All that is left out because of the soul of man. Now, historically, in terms of Jewish philosophy, this issue as to how a Jew on the perfect level should come to emunah, to faith, was an issue of great controversy. The Rambam, for example, and many other Rishonim, Rav Sadia Gaon and Rabbeinu Bechai, all of them quote a pasuk in Iyov, which starts with the word da. How would you translate the word da? No, to know something. Da es ha'elokei avicha v'avdehu, Iyov claims. Da means to know. Knowledge comes from the intellect, from the mind. Rabbi Yehuda Levi, the author of the Kuzari, on the other hand, and Rav Yosef Albo, who authored a great work called Emunot V'Deot, which is totally exclusively dedicated to the concept of Emunah, they took a different approach. The first approach, that of the Rambam, was Da. That's the Da approach. Know God. Analyze. Prove. Use your intellect, your cerebellum. But according to Rav Albo, and I'll read to you just a few lines from his classic, I mean, you're going back nine centuries in history, he says, why was Nishtabech Avram Avinu, why is it that Avram Avinu is on such a high level? Shel Emunah, he's the man of faith. V'amara katuv alav, v'emin b'ashem v'yechshevel litzdaka, that he believes in God. He says the following, that what is Avraham Avinu's Emunah? Lohorot ki Emunah hi lemala min hayidiyah. It's something that goes above analysis, philosophical analysis. Umin hadvarim hativim. According to Rav Albo, Avraham Avinu came to Emunah in a natural sort of way. He calls it teva. So these are the two approaches, and the issue again at stake is how a person should come to belief in God. So let's take a look at Rav Kook, which you'll see on page 1. I'm not going to read the entire text, because they gave me 45 minutes tonight. That would not be enough to read just this one text alone. And I want to get to two other texts of Rav Kook. So I have great hopes, and then I want to end up with something more inspiring from Rav Kook. And so what I'm going to do here is, I am going to sort of translate the text into English to the best of my ability, as again, as I said at the outset, Rav Kook's Hebrew is murder, is terribly difficult. And I've tried this many times, but this time I think I understand what he's saying. But I'm not going to read the text. So for those of you who like to see Rav Kook's words inside, and you can stop me as I go along, follow me in the text. I am going to just express his ideas in English. Maybe I'll focus on a few words in Hebrew as well. He says the following. That this issue about who's greater, Michael or Gabriel, these two very vibrant angels, the issue at stake here is about belief in God, about Emunah itself. And he says the following. There are two ways of achieving belief. One, Rav Kook calls Derech Chochmah, through wisdom, through intellect, through knowledge, through analysis, and hit palsifut, that's philosophizing. And he says, to do that, you're going to have to analyze, and you're going to have to come up with different arguments and proofs. Then he says there's a second way, and he calls it tmimut, or yashrut, as we discussed earlier. And now he quotes from Yehuda Levi, the great author of the Kuzari and many of our liturgical poems. He was a great poet, and he's known for his love, his boundless love for the land of Israel. So it doesn't surprise us that Rav Kook would quote the Kuzari, but he gives the Kuzari a grade, a very good grade. He says, "Uvitzedek," And it's absolutely justified that the Kuzari lavishes praise on the approach of Tmimut way beyond that of Mechkar al pi Chochma, meaning analysis based on wisdom. And here he says this is the difference between Gavriel and Michael. Gavriel personifies an angel who is completely dedicated to Chochma u'mechkar, to wisdom and analysis. And he quotes many verses in Tanakh to prove this. And what's common to all these verses is that Gavriel is, as we said, the paradigm of a thinker, of someone who proves God's existence logically. Michael, on the other hand, he's there as the representative of the people of Israel. He's the Tsar. He is the celestial governor, so to speak, that represents the people of Israel. And again, quoting many psukim. And therefore, Michael, to represent the people of Israel, is dedicated to tefillah, to prayer. Prayer, says Rav Kook, is something that evokes or is emitted by emotion, by the heart. And he says that Michael personifies the self, the soul, the natural approach to emunah, yashrut and tmimut. And therefore, this sugya, this agadata that we're studying, puts all the emphasis here on Michael. Michael is superior to Gavriel, as we said, in two ways. Number one, we see the active agency of Michael, whereas Gavriel is passive. And number two, we saw that Gavriel takes two leaps in order to achieve what Michael could achieve. And Rav Kook goes on to say the following, that although there is a valid method of achieving wisdom and knowledge of God through yeda, through analysis, and not only that, he says, which is very fascinating, for those of you who may have studied at some point in your life at Yeshiva University, the motto of which is Torah Umada. Take a look at what Rav Kook thinks about Torah Umada. He writes, and this was fascinating to me, that to know God doesn't require that you analyze God according to the books of the Bible and the Talmud and so forth and so on, but even deot chutz l'toratenu, even philosophical knowledge that is outside the four cubits of the Torah, that can also help, and you can achieve this derech hakodesh, which is called emunah, faith. However, he says there's a fundamental difference between these two approaches. Why is the approach of Michael superior to that of Gavriel? We've proven it textually, but conceptually, why is it so? What is it about this emunah, the faith that's based on yashrut and tmimut, what makes that superior? And Rav Kook claims the following. He says that when your faith is based on a natural sense, you're not dependent on anything external. It's within yourself. It's natural. He calls it nitiyat tiv'it belev Ha'adam. It's a natural tendency to believe in God, and it's built into the very soul of man. Ein tzorech l'davar michutz Allah. He's not dependent on anything that's external, but rather he can achieve shleimut and perfection in emunah based on his own natural feelings. Now elsewhere, in the writings of Rav Kook, he tries to understand if emunah could be natural, intuitive, why is it that so many people have problems with emunah? But that's a different discussion, not for us tonight. And he says the following, that the reason why the Torah, the Tanakh, lavishes so much praise on Michael is because his kinyan, his acquisition of emunah, is absolutely faultless. It's it doesn't sway with the wind. You know, you can't raise questions or objections that would put doubts in his mind. He's absolutely definite. It's smooth. It represents simplicity and natural perfection. Now, I just wanted to add one comment to my own, and if anyone has questions, please stop me. Philosophers throughout history have identified two sources or origins to human knowledge. Obviously, the classic source of human knowledge is the intellect. But many philosophers believed in what they called intuition. Now, it's very hard to define intuition. You could Google it and see what the Wikipedia defines it. I don't have access to a computer. But I will tell you this, intuition is something which is like a sixth sense. And the Kuzari, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, over and over again speaks about this concept of intuition. And what Rav Kook is presenting here is the thesis that what you know intuitively gives you, grants you, or generates in you a stronger belief and an absolute conviction than even that which you know with your intellect. So, for example, if you would talk about the history of Talmudic thinking, you're always limited to the intellect. But if you're going to go beyond that and discuss knowledge in general, and certainly from the perspective of the Kuzari and Rav Kook, there's an even more fundamental way that a human being could come to knowledge that's not based on the intellect at all. It's not based on, you know, the rigorous analysis of what they call Talmudic didactics and all that's involved, you know, knowing each one of the principles and the questions and the answers. You can skip all that and somehow go right to the core because of your intuitive understanding. And in the case of belief in God, there is such a thing as intuitive belief in God. You pick up your arm and it functions and you feel it. And that's intuitive knowledge. And those who took that approach, which is much more of a mystical approach, gave superior weight and they prefer that kind of knowledge to intellectual knowledge. Intellectual knowledge is always subject to arguments, counter-arguments, and doubts, and so forth and so on. One more point, and then I'll take questions. The great founder of Lubavitch, the Alter Rebbe, was asked the question, why is it that historically, in terms of what we call Kiddush Hashem, it was the simple Jew, so to speak, Yehudia Pashut, the rank and file Jew, who gave his life without hesitating for Kiddush Hashem? And the Alter Rebbe said that we would have thought intuitively that it's the intellect, you know, those who are the great scholars, they would have been the first online to give up their lives. And many of them, he said, came up with explanations and justifications that they don't have to give up life. But the simple Jew, again, don't misunderstand me, the simple Jew is on the highest level in the philosophy of Ladi, of Rav Shneur Zalman. And he was able to give up his life without hesitation. He had this intuitive love of God that stemmed from the soul. And that mystical kind of love of God is so profound that these Jews never had any hesitations. They weren't interested in justifying. They were there right up front to give up their life. Questions here? Excellent, excellent. The adjective ish means that he's a human being. Michal represents these mystical concepts that are superhuman in a sense. They go beyond the intellect.
Just the intuitive thing. Sometimes the Gemara will say, we don't need a pasuk.
Interesting.
Also be intuitive, right?
We don't have time to answer your question properly because it really requires at least an hour. You've heard of Reb Shimon Shkop? Rav Shimon Shkop was famous for asking the question over and over again. We find throughout Shas, Ibai same Akra, Ibai same as Svara. And he used to always prove from that Svara is just on the same level, Doraisa, as a Akra, as a Pasuk, as a derivation from the verse. And he would ask the question, well, how can we derive a Doraisa from a Svara? I mean, if there's a Pasuk, there's a source for it in the Torah, the Nicha, but what about a Svara? And he comes up with a whole description, you'll see it in Shari Yosher from Shimon Shkop, of what the word Svara means. It would take us literally a lifetime to try to figure out what Svara means. But basically the idea of Svara is not what you would call human logic. In other words, it's not anti-logical, but it's not human logic. You know, if you took out a book on logic, I remember when I was in college, I took basic logic, and you know, it's all symbols, you know. But you would not be able to understand Svara based on human logic. It operates within a halachic universe, so to speak, with its own rules and regulations. Now, what we'd like to do is try to understand Chag HaPesach as the Chag of Geula. I'm sorry, scratch that. It's all the Chag of Geula, but what I'm interested in tonight is Chag HaEmunah as the holiday of faith. And try to understand that in Rav Kook's perspective. Now for this, before you turn the page, I want to quote to you another piece from Rav Kook that you don't have on your page. And this is from his magnum opus called Orot Yisrael. This is the classical text and presentation of Rav Kook's philosophy. In that book, Rav Kook tries to analyze the relationship between Pesach and Shavuot. And he claims the following, that the reason why on Leil HaPesach we declare time and time again that God exists, that God took us out of Egypt, He brought all the miracles, but there's no intellectual analysis, no chachma in understanding God or proving God's existence. He says because Pesach represents the holiday of intuitive knowledge of God, of what he calls Tmimut and Yashrut. And it's very interesting to combine these two pieces, because at this point Rav Kook deviates a little bit from what he said in his Pirush on the Agadah, that he says the following, that there are two modes and two methods of coming to believe in God, and he says both will get you to the same place, but you've got to do it in sequence. There's a chronological order. The order has to be Pesach and then Sfirat HaOmer, culminating in Shavuot. And I was very excited about that. I thought it was Min HaShemayim that this would come up tonight because of the Sfira period that we're in, and perhaps we can connect it to Yom HaTzmaut. And Rav Kook claims the following, that Pesach is the holiday of intuitive belief in God. It represents the Yashrut and the Tmimut. And now we build up step by step to another mode of belief in God, to develop an intellectual understanding of how and why we're committed to the belief in God. And that is the Sfira period that culminates with what we call Kabbalat HaTorah, the acceptance of the Torah on Chag HaShavuot. So that Chag HaShavuot, which is called Naaseh V'Nishma, according to Rav Kook, represents a different mode, which is more typical of Gavriel, not Michael, meaning the intellectual Chachma and the Seichel, and that is an enhancement of Emunah. But says Rav Kook, you got to do it in order. You have to first have this intuitive sense and commitment to belief in God, and that's represented by Pesach, and then step by step, develop it, embellish it, till it reaches a higher level, more of a shleimut, with an intellectual understanding of God. And that is the sphere period that, as we said before, culminates with Chag HaShavuot. But now I'd like you to turn to the next page, which is the flip side of your page. I don't have to tell you that Rav Kook was a great lover of the land of Israel. But what I want to show you in this piece, and then see if we can connect it, and if I rush, it's a little bit because of the time constraint. Anyone who could stay a little bit later, I'll be less pressured. But in this piece that we're about to look at here, which is a work, the same work that we mentioned before, the Agadata, we're going to appreciate Rav Kook's, number one, homiletic ability. We saw it already in the Gemara in Brachos about Gavriel and Michal, but now we're going to see it in an unbelievable way. Really revolutionary. And it's an amazing method. And anyone here in the audience who's afraid to learn Rav Kook, and I don't blame you for that, because I was afraid for many, many decades. I'm not going to tell you how many. But what I would encourage you to start with is the Ein Ayah, his commentary on the Agadah. So I don't know if here in the shul, any group of people are learning Brachot, Masechet Brachot. But if you're learning Masechet Brachot, and you're not skipping the Agadah, which makes up, you know, a large, large chunk of that Masechet, then learn it with Ein Ayah. But again, you have to be ready to plow through the Hebrew. Here's a piece in which he analyzes a Gemara that is absolutely halachic, and he sees in it a whole revolution about Eretz Yisrael. So let me read to you the pasuk in Dvarim Ches, and then the Gemara on the top of your page 2. The pasuk says the following, and you know, if I had a whiteboard, I would flash it on the whiteboard, you know. It says the following, Eretz, this is the description of the land of Israel. Now, I'm using my fingers to count, because the numbers are very important here. Chita, Usa'ora, V'gefen, gefen are grapes. U'teina, right, the figs. V'rimon, and pomegranates. Then it says eretz, and it says zeit shemen u'dvash. Zeit shemen is a reference to olives, and dvash, believe it or not, is a reference to dates. Okay, dvash tamarim. So the Gemara records a dialogue between Rav Chisda and Rav Hemnuna, and they were sitting. This is what stimulated the dialogue. They were sitting at a suda at a meal, and they brought in front of them both dates and pomegranates. So Rav Hemnuna surprised us, and what did he do? Barich atamrei bereisha. There's a halach of seder brachot, right? The sequence of brachot. And he, Rav Hemnuna, decided that he's got to start with tmarim. Now, if you remember, there was eretz and five, then there was eretz and two. If you combine the two, what number on the list is tmarim? Okay, five plus two, that's not high in mathematics. Seven, right, I think. Did I get that right? Five plus two is seven, okay. Nobody laughed, but anyway. So now we get to tmarim. And of all things, you know, Rimon is number five on the list. Tmarim is number seven on the list. You would think that if the verse is giving us a Seder of Brachos and Chashivus, then he should have started with Rimon. Ole Rav Chisda. So Rav Chisda objects to Rav Hemnuna, and he says, Lo svir le mar kol amukdam bepasuk ze mukdam le bracha. That this, the whatever early in the pasuk is, comes first in bracha. Amolo ze sheni la'aretz v'ze chamishi la'aretz. So you're all familiar with this Gemara. The word eretz appears twice in this verse, and we start counting the various species to see how close they are to the word eretz. It doesn't matter whether it's the first eretz or the second eretz. So how far is it between tmarim and eretz? Two. And how far is it from Rimon to the first Eretz? Five. Therefore, Tmarim gets Kedima over Rimon. And that's how we paskin in Shulchan Aruch, like Rav Hemnuna against Rav Chisda. Again, a purely halachic legal Gemara. Technically, you know, when I was a kid, they used to say that back in Europe, I don't know if you've ever heard this, when a young man came in as a possible suitor for the Baal Bas's daughter, they used to take out fruits and see which bracha he would make first. Does that ring a bell? Anyway, that's how they tested a young man to see if he learned well in yeshiva. They wanted to see if he knew Seder brachot. So imagine, they bring out dates, and they bring out pomegranates, and he lunges for a pomegranate, and then Michal comes down, just joking, and moves his hand over to take the date, so he can get the date. In any event, I see no one's appreciating my humor tonight, so you're not going to invite me back. Anyway, so here's what goes on. Rav Kook claims that this Gemara is not technical. I mean, it is technical, he doesn't deny that, but should not be understood on the level of, exclusively on the level of technicality and halacha and law about the Seder HaBrachot, but has a much deeper meaning for us. And he coins a phrase here, which he uses over and over again, called Chibat HaAretz, the love for the land. And he claims the following, that there are two approaches to the love for land. Again, the love for the land, Chibat HaAretz, is like a living movement in Rav Kook's writing. It's almost something that's alive. It's like a being. Chibat HaAretz. And he says the following. He says that the first Eretz is going to present one category of Chibat HaAretz. The second is going to present a different category of Chibat HaAretz. And again, just like we spoke earlier about two modes of belief and how to come to Emunah, there are two ways of experiencing, or two motivations for Chibat HaAretz. The first, he says, is on a very high level. Someone is motivated by the spirituality of the land, by the fact that here is the land that God chose, the land of our forefathers, the land of the mitzvot hatzliot ba'aretz, all the seder zeroyim, you know, all the agricultural laws, etc. But then he says there are those who are motivated by chibat haaretz for a totally different reason. He calls it material and physical, and he says that this is going to be the refuge and the place that's secure on the globe for the Jewish people. And he says the following. He says that the second Eretz is symbolically a reference to the category of those who are on a lower level, who are motivated by the material dimension of Chibat Haaretz, the physical dimension, which is finite. The first Haaretz, and that's why it comes first, is for a higher level. It represents appreciation for the Haaretz on a spiritual, infinite level. And therefore, he says, it makes absolute sense that Rav Chisda would get up and object and say that Tmarim, right, should come last, right? Because that's after the second Eretz. That's Rav Chisda. Are you with me so far? In other words, the pomegranates are connected to which Eretz?
Spiritual.
The first Eretz. That's the spiritual Eretz. That's the infinite Eretz. Whereas the Tmarim are related to the physical, material, limited, finite Eretz. Comes along Rav Kook, and he says something unbelievable. That Rav Chisda had a problem, but at the end of the day, Rav Hamnuna wins it out. I mean, we pass like Rav Hamnuna. And what that means is that we're going to look at both Eretz, and we're going to equate them, no matter what your motivation is. And therefore, we're going to ask the question, well, which species is closer to Eretz? Who, what category of individuals represent a more profound Chibat Haaretz? And these are symbolized by the various species. And the species called Tmarim get preference over Rimonim. Why? Because Tmarim are only second to Eretz, even though it's the lower level Eretz. And at this point, Rav Kook goes on to say that even though, I'm going to read his language, Yesh Misha Mechabev Eretz HaKodesh, about halfway through the paragraph, Yishtadel B'Yishuva B'Dirata B'Shvil Shemakir B'HaTachlit Shal Minucha, Minucha means security, Chumrit, which means physical, L'Klal Yisrael, not just for himself, but for the benefit of Klal Yisrael. He says that's also a Davar Tov in his Gav. It's on a very lofty level. But then he goes on, and he drops what I call the bomb, and he says that this level of loving the land for Chumriyut because of its physicality, to some extent, supersedes the level of Chibat Haaretz on the spiritual level. So on the one hand, there's a paradox, a dialectic. On the one hand, the first Eretz represents the higher level of Eretz, because that's a commitment to the land of Israel and a love therein because of its spirituality and infinity, the divine presence of Eretz Yisrael. But at the same time, we're going to give preference to, in this case, Dvash Tmarim, over Rimon, because it's closer to Eretz, because it has a much more profound relationship to the love, the Chibat Haaretz, on a Chumri level, on a physical level. And this, my friends, I don't have to tell you, if you know anything at all about Rav Kook, his love for the settlers, you know, I'm talking about the Chalutzim, who went into the swamps and drained the waters of the swamps, the malaria-ridden waters. His love for them was endless, was boundless. So what we're seeing here in Rav Kook, I want to just summarize 3 points in this Rav Kook, and then see if we can connect this with the first Rav Kook. Point number one is an amazing histaklut, you know, a vision, so to speak, or a perspective on Agadita, or in this case on Halacha as Agadita, in a sense synthesizing and integrating Halacha with Agada, with philosophy. Number two, what's mind-boggling here is the concept of Chibat Haaretz as a profound living kind of entity. And number three, which is the most radical of them all, is the fact that Rav Kook is willing to recognize the superior level of Chibat Haaretz of the Tmarim because they're closest to Eretz, even though they fit into the second Eretz category, which is the mode of love for the land based on material Chomriyut and the fact that it's a place for protection. How many people here in this room, I'm just curious, have ever heard of Rav Soloveitchik's Sheish Tfikot? Anybody? No? Okay, so the Sheish Tfikot, Rav Soloveitchik, I'll just say very quickly because we don't have time, but Rav Soloveitchik says that amongst the various metaphoric and symbolic meanings to Shir Hashirim, which is a dialogue according to Chazal in Torah Shebaal Peh between the Dod representing the Almighty and the Raya representing Knesset Yisrael, one of the dimensions is about the love for the land of Israel. And Rav Soloveitchik claims that there are six times that the Dod, meaning God, knocks on the door of the Raya, of the beloved. And these six knocks represent the six knocks of the establishment of the state of Israel. It's one of the most, if not the most, eloquent statement of religious Zionism. It's incredible. Again, if you ask the Rav what he felt the next day, I'm not sure. You know, anybody who knows Rav Soloveitchik, he changed his mind from day to day. But in any event, this is an unbelievable piece. But I want to point out, just in passing, that out of the six, four out of the six represent the second Chibat Haaretz of Rav Kook. Namely, the idea that the Jewish homeland is a refuge for any Jew to come. And if you know the history, I don't have to tell you, you know, when Soviet Jews, the Jews of silence as we called them in our youth, were able to, after the fall, were able to come out, they had a place to go in Israel. Or you talk about Mediterranean Jews, you know, Iraq and Syria and Iran and so forth. So the gates of Israel are open for Jews. So again, Rav Soloveitchik goes into the whole concept of protecting the people, the fact that we have a military power. He even, not in that particular essay, but elsewhere, said that the flag of Israel might have sanctity homiletically, not halakhically, because of all the Jews who gave their lives for the flag of Israel and so forth and so on. But it's fascinating to me, and here's the interface, the overlap between Rav Kook and Rav Soloveitchik, that they both see Chibat Haaretz not only in terms of spirituality and the mitzvot atzliot bar, but also in terms of physicality. Just to swing back to the first Rav Kook and see if we can find a connection between the two. We say that there are two approaches to emunah, to faith. One is tmimut. We said it was natural, it was intuitive. The other is seichel, is chachma, it's intellect, it's analysis. Perhaps there's a certain parallel between those two modes of emunah and the two modes of chibat haaretz. Perhaps, this is just Berzon speaking. And I would say the following, that you could love Israel on two levels. You know, you can love Israel on intellectual level. You talk about the land, you talk about the freedom, you talk about establishing a state with its own laws, you talk about the protection for the Jewish people. All that is intellectual. But then there's something that flows from the heart. There's something that's intuitive. There's something that's natural. It's yashar, it's a certain yashar, it's a certain love for the land that goes beyond the intellect. You know, I'm not going to give you a list of all the accomplishments of the state. You know, that you can do, I call it the Dayenu list. You know, I don't know if you have ever gone through, you'll see it online. It's worth it. It should be part of the ritual of Yom HaTzmud on an annual basis that you go through the list of contributions of the state of Israel to mankind. Does anybody know what I'm talking about? I mean, you're talking about Nobel Prizes. You're talking about every area of human knowledge that you can think of. Although, I have to admit, I got a little lost here with Waze. But anyway, you know, Waze is another Israeli invention, which was bought up by Google for $1.1 billion. They underpaid. Anyway, so getting back to this, what I want to suggest is the following. That Rav Kook puts on the highest level this emunah, which is shleimut, which is yashrut, which is tmimut, that certain straightness, that smooth, absolutely soul-inspired, that comes from the depths of man, that is emunah, and that too can be identified as chibat haaretz. And perhaps that chibat haaretz, which is natural, which is within our own love, it's a gravitational pull to the land, that from Rav Kook's perspective is the highest level. And it doesn't have anything to do necessarily with man's spirituality. You know, the statistics that I saw is that there are 120,000 Jews in Israel who are sitting and learning Torah day and night. You know, that's the religious element of Chibat Haaretz. And that's great, that's amazing. But Rav Kook is putting and shifting the emphasis on not the religious, you know, performance, but rather on a certain gravitational love for the land of Israel. And I think that's what the Kuzari was all about. So I promised you that I'd like to end the Shia tonight with something inspirational from Rav Kook. So this is not on your pages. And I know I'm going over time, but I'll just take 2 or 3 minutes. And I want to learn with you a Gemara at the end of Masechet Ketuvot. And at the end of Ketuvot, it's the last Gemara. A lot of people know this Gemara because if you've ever heard of Siyum, you know the Gemara. It's the last Gemara in Ketuvot. The Gemara is all about the love for the land of Israel. That's how the Gemara ends Masechet Ketuvot. Just like Ketuvot is about the love of a husband for a wife, so too the Masechet ends with the love of a Jew for the land of Israel. And the Gemara goes through various stories of people who, you know, fasted in order to know Torah Eretz Yisrael and to forget Torah Chutz La'aretz. But a million stories about Amoraim and how much they loved the land of Israel. So the Gemara concludes with a description of Rav Chiya Bar Gamda. And when Rav Chiya Bar Gamda arrives at the shores of Israel, Hayim is Golel the Afra. He got off his camel or his donkey and he rolled in the dirt of Israel. You may know, I don't know if you've ever seen it with your eyes, but some of the old timers, especially Sfaradim and Yemenites, they will kiss the ground when they get to the land of Israel. It's all based on this Gemara about Rav Chiya. And the Gemara says, Shen Nemar, quoting a pasuk in David HaMelech in Tehillim, Ki rotsu avadecha es avaneha vesafar yechonon. Because your servants, O God, want the stones of Israel and they love the dirt of Israel. So Rav Kook asked the obvious question. Why mention the stones? You've mentioned the afar, the very dirt of the land. That's the adoma. From that things grow, and that's that olives, zeroim is. Why do you mention avanim? So he says the following. There are two ways of understanding the love and the gravitational pull that a Jew has for the land. One is called the afar. Afar means the land which is sanctified with Kedushat Eretz Yisrael, and anything that I plant in the land and it grows has all the mitzvahs of Zeroyim, Trumas, and Maisers, and Leket, Shikha, and Peah, etc., etc., etc. But he says in Evan, what can you plant in a stone? Nothing. What the Evan represents, says Rav Kook, is the absolute love for the land of Israel. Independent of the afar, which could produce the mitzvos hatluyos baretz. And when I learned this Rav Kook, I automatically thought of Rav Chaim Cohen, who's quoted at the end of Tosfos and Ksuvos, that in our time, Kedushas Eretz Yisrael is not in full force, we don't have the mitzvahs of Trumas and Maisers, and therefore there's no mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael. And the Avnei Nezer, the Sokhet Shomer, writes about that Tosfos, that it was never written. It's a mistake. There's no such statement of Rav Chaim Cohen. Talmud Torah Kosva. But in any event, what it says over there is that Eretz Yisrael and my love there is just a means to an end to create peros and tfuah and fulfill the mitzvahs atzilus part. So everything depends upon Kedushas Eretz Yisrael. Says Rav Kook, no. There's a different type of love for Eretz Yisrael. I love Eretz Yisrael because I love its stones. I love it even though you can't plant a thing, even though it's not a means to an end, and you cannot achieve the mitzvot hatluyot baretz. So I just want to end with a tefillah, with a prayer to the Ribono Shel Olam. He should give and protect and give place all his blessings on the land. You know, we need it. We need it desperately now. I don't know what's going on with these peace talks. I don't know, you know what do they call it? A hafsakat eish? How do you say it in English? Ceasefire. I don't know. I'm very perplexed by it. But you know, Jewish history is a zigzag, and it goes up and it goes down. But Emir Tzashem, the history of Israel, 71 years. It's not that long. Is a glorious history. It has many, many ups. We're praying and we're hoping that for the physical protection, for the love of the land, the Chibat Haaretz. I hope you enjoyed this little excursion into the philosophy of Rav Kook. Again, it's very challenging to make sense out of Rav Kook, but I hope and I pray that we did so. And we should always be together to commemorate such a wonderful day as Yom HaTzma'ut, and we should be zochet to see Mashiach Tzidkenu b'mehrav yameinu. If anybody wants to ask any questions, and, yeah, please.
For the first type of emunah, we say that Abraham was a typo. But how about the second one? Can we start one from the second type of reference?
That, well, in terms of Rav Kook's writings, it's Gavriel the Malach who represents Seichel. But according to the Rambam, it's all the Rishonim who came from the intellectual school. And Rabbi Bechai was the Talmud of Ramban. You know, all these came from the Degel. You know, they waved the flag of the intellectual approach, you know, to try to prove God's existence. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, sir. Beautiful.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks.
Beautiful.
I like your intuition of the intellectual.
Yeah, okay.